ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
New research finds freezing blood platelets may help save more lives, especially in regional and remote parts of Australia.
They only have a shelf life of 7 days in Australia, and that means that really it's not possible to supply platelets to anything other than hospitals that have a fairly high and a predictable demand, which means that if you have a car crash in country Australia and you're taken to the local hospital, there's no platelets there.
And we're going to head to a nursing home in Townsville where the residents there were quite happy to share their ideas of how young people can fill up their time without social media.
My brother and I, who are fairly close together, and my dad used to go to the races, so him and I do a running commentary on a race, like, you know, we used it for horses, and it was called a beetle bomb, like beetle bombs coming down the straight and Blackfeet's coming up and our beetle bomb wins, you know.
Oh, beetle bomb.
Yeah, beetle bomb, you remember beetle bomb?
Yeah.
I'm Sinead Mangan and this is Australia Wide, coming to you from Whadjuk Country, Perth.
Hi there, students. It's the Prime Minister here and I want to speak to you directly about something very important. From December 10, if you're under 16, you're no longer allowed to have a social media account.
Prime Minister Anthony Albanese. After more than a year of planning, global scrutiny and debate, Australia's social media ban for people aged under 16 has officially started, marking a world-first push to protect children from online harms and screen addiction. While the law officially is kicked in, tech giant Meta began removing Instagram threads and Facebook accounts last week. Other platforms affected by the ban include TikTok, Snapchat, X and YouTube. They'll face a $50 million fine if they don't take reasonable steps to stop children and teens aged under 16 from holding a social media account. Reaction to the ban has been split, though. While there's broad support for improving online safety, critics of the ban say it's unworkable and teens will find a way around it. Andrew Wenzel is the manager of the Albany branch of Youth Mental Health Centre Headspace, and he's based in regional Western Australia. Now, Andrew, youth mental health and safety is literally at the core of what you do. The government is arguing that this is central to its social media ban today. How's it been received by the young people you work with?
Look, I think it's kind of using a blunt instrument approach to tackling a particular problem. Absolutely, there's no argument that for some young people, in some situations, there is significant harm that does come about through social media and that is facilitated through social media. But I feel like while addressing the harms, we're also throwing out the baby with the bathwater and blocking all of the good that social media is able to bring, because it wouldn't be so pervasive through all aspects of all of our lives if it wasn't for some good as well. It was very interesting listening to your introduction, Sinead, because we've seen the tech companies starting to do things now because of the ban. Surely the tech companies could have done things to regulate some of the safety concerns without having to ban the use for 13 to 16-year-olds.
Mm. When you talk about the good that social media bring to young people, what sort of things are you talking about?
Well, the same things that I guess we all use social media for connectivity, for fun, for relaxation. I guess coming from a regional part of Western Australia or Australia, for kids in the country, it means connection at times when they may not be around other young people their own age. You know, kids going home for school holidays or even home on the school bus might be tens, hundreds of kilometres away from their friends. And it's a way of connecting, of staying in touch, of being able to reach out and seek support and bounce ideas off each other that has become, you know, something that we all use social media for. For some particular populations, particularly things like young queer kids or kids with particular special interests, the social media ban hits doubly hard on them.
I suppose some would argue, though, that you could do, you know, you can keep connected via text or via WhatsApp. There's many ways to keep connected. You don't need necessarily what's called social media to do that.
That is true, provided you've got decent mobile phone reception, which is another issue for people living in regional Western Australia. There may be, you know, satellite Wi-Fi, but may not come with mobile signal. And I think You know, one of the things that I love working in the area we do is seeing the creativity of young people. No doubt there will be solutions that come about to make sure that young people are able to be connected. Some of those solutions will be welcome, and some of them we might look on as adults and question. You know, we're already starting to hear about what facial expressions you can pull to fool some of the age screening tools that social media platforms are starting to use. And no doubt there will be workarounds, if you want to call it that. And no doubt there will be new things that come as a result of the ban as well, because I think there is no end to the creativity of young people in trying to solve problems.
There will be workarounds, there's no doubt that's what's going to happen. Do you worry about that, you know, that covert nature of those workarounds and what harms could come of that?
The worry should actually be on the way that the implementation of the ban has forced young people into sort of looking at some of these options, because any other option has been taken away from them. It does mean that some young people might inadvertently find themselves, or inadvertently is the wrong word, intentionally find themselves, if they're using workarounds, in situations where they're exposed to harm. But where I think the good is that the onus is actually on the platform companies themselves, and they are the ones who will be fined if their means of gating age of users isn't good enough. One wonders, though, how enforceable those fines are across international jurisdictions, and whether tech companies will actually, you know, respond in the way that that's intended.
At Headspace, have kids given you any sort of feedback about how they feel about this, what could be a major part of their lives being taken away from them?
Not a lot of kids have been talking about it. We've been preparing kids and been prepared to have those conversations. And I think it's, you know, a beautiful insight into the emotional and psychological lives of young people around us that live in the moment.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, being in the background and, oh, I've just crashed into it because it's here now and I can't avoid it. Which, again, is what makes social media so useful, in that ability to be connected and share stories and ideas straight away, but also what makes social media so harmful, in that, you know, sometimes people might use their mouths or use weaponized conversations or information without necessarily stopping to think about the consequences.
Do you expect Headspace to get busy in the short term?
I think we will certainly have some young people that perhaps hadn't considered things and find themselves in kind of caught out. I think, you know, there are situations also socially where a 16-year-old might have a group of friends who are 16 and 17 and suddenly feels excluded from the friend group because the rest of the group are able to continue to use social media. Those are some of those kind of nuanced little situations that are going to impact on some young people. But again, that just need conversation and understanding and validation to work through.
Manager of Headspace in Albany in Western Australia, Andrew Wenzel, speaking to me a little earlier. And later in the programme, we're going to go to a nursing home in Townsville, where the residents there were quite happy to share their ideas of how young people could fill up their time without social media. It's quite hilarious, to be honest.
ABC Australia Wide.
A lot of us will need blood donations in our lifetime, and inside that blood is a precious platelet that forms clots and helps stop bleeding. Up until now, blood platelets had a very short shelf life, with a third of donations being discarded worldwide, which is one reason they aren't readily available in remote and regional areas. But that could change now, thanks to new research. Jack Kiernan has more.
I have heard that if it happens to you in your sleep, you're not going to make it.
Colleen Styler-Hunt was attending a Christmas in July work party when the fight of her life took hold.
My fight or flight kicked in, and I was like, I just said to the man I was talking to, I have no idea what he just said. I just said, I'm going to go back to the staff room. And he said, you don't look great. Let me get someone. So he went and got the first aid people, and they called the ambulance.
The 51-year-old had suffered an aortic dissection, which is a rare but life-threatening medical emergency. What followed for Ms. Styler-Hunt was open-heart surgery over 2 days at the Prince Charles Hospital in Brisbane to repair the tear.
During my surgery, I had to have a lot of blood products. Some of those were platelets, which they would have done during the surgery. Yeah, even when I was in the ICU, they were just changing bag after bag after blood.
Blood platelets played a crucial role in saving Colleen's life, but are often not available in regional and remote and military hospitals.
The platelets have to be stored at room temperature. They're very, very fragile. They only have a shelf life of 7 days in Australia, and that means that really it's not possible to supply platelets to anything other than hospitals that have a fairly high and a predictable demand, which means that if you have a car crash in country Australia and you're taken to the local hospital, there's no platelets there.
Professor Paul Reid from the University of Queensland is the lead author on the joint collaboration with Australian Red Cross Lifeblood, their research testing the effectiveness of using frozen blood platelets for transfusion has just been published in the Journal of the American Medical Association.
By freezing the platelets, which isn't quite as simple as it sounds, it's not just a matter of sticking them in the freezer, but by freezing them, we extend the shelf life of those platelets to 2 years, and that makes it possible to supply regional and rural hospitals with a platelet supply for patients who are bleeding.
Professor Reid saw the need for the research while on deployment in Afghanistan in 2009. He first discovered the use of the frozen platelets at a Dutch hospital in Tarinkout.
They seem to work, they weren't registered for clinical use anywhere outside the Netherlands for that military application. So it struck me that they'd be particularly applicable not only for our own Defence Force, but for use in regional and rural Australia as well.
Nearly 400 patients from across 11 Australian hospitals participated in the study.
We have had the ability to use frozen platelets in the Australian Defence Force since about 2014. And we've always had the desire in defence to use products that are registered for general use. We've created discovered enough evidence that we hope will be sufficient to register them for general use.
The Australian Medical Association Queensland says it supports the study's findings. In a statement, President Dr. Nick Yim said the results are promising and suggests further research is warranted to see if frozen platelets could be effectively used in other situations. Colleen Styler-Hunt is hopeful the crucial blood product that saved her life can be made available across the country.
Definitely regional and rural areas, remote areas, even urban areas, and also, I guess, defence forces as well. I think it's really exciting. To everyone who has donated, I say thank you because and it could have been exactly your donation. It could be why I'm here today.
Colleen Styler-Hunt, finishing that story from Jake Kiernan. It's a week that marks World Human Rights Day, and there are concerns Australia's current human rights system is not effectively serving First Nations Australians. Some are calling for serious reform to allow Aboriginal Australians more opportunities to appeal decisions that affect them on a human rights basis. Charlie Mills has this story.
Woonanibali woman Elsa Coffin is the leader of a small group of Aboriginal Australians hailing from WA's Pilbara region. Since 2010, the group have been trying to get native title recognition over their cultural lands at Roy Hill, around 1,000 kilometres north of Perth. But after their claim was rejected in Australia's courts, Ms Coffin took her case to the United Nations.
We have been robbed. We've been denied any rights. I feel like that we've been just disregarded as a people.
In 2023, the UN Human Rights Committee found in favour of the Woonanibali, ruling Australia had breached its international human rights obligations. A year later, the finding was rejected by then Attorney General Mark Dreyfus, who said the committee had mischaracterised Australia's native title process and no breaches had occurred. That left the Woonanibali with few options for domestic legal recourse.
I don't have any faith in the justice system, and I don't have any faith in the Australian government.
Ms Coffin's legal representative at the UN, Scott Cownan, says the fight isn't ending, but he says the government's position has the potential for massive impact.
It's also alarming for my clients because they're currently in the situation where their land is subject to mining, and they are excluded from their land. If they're going to teach their laws and customs to their younger people, they need to go on their land. This is actually a sort of survival question for the Woonanibali.
He says the position doesn't pass the pub test, and any regular Australian would be shocked at how the case has been handled.
The longer the government stonewalls, resists, the harder it will find to justify its position.
Legal experts say it reveals a significant gap in Australia's human rights system. Unlike other Western democracies with Indigenous populations like Canada and New Zealand, Australia is somewhat unique in not having its own Human Rights Act at the federal level. Curtin University law professor and Noongar woman Dr. Hannah McGlade says it contributes to Australia's often controversial human rights framework.
We don't have a Human Rights Act nationally. We don't have a Human Rights Charter to protect those rights. And while we've signed and are bound by UN treaties, we're not seeing our governments be responsive to those treaty processes, including where decisions are made about human rights violations that have occurred in this country.
She says Australia's current approach is representative of a failure to close the gap in key areas like incarceration and mental health.
It's not a large bow to draw that there is a correlation between human rights violations and the failure of these policies and the widening gap in those particular areas.
Australia has on numerous occasions not implemented the recommendations of UN committees. International law professor Dr. Fiona McGoffey says that often causes tension between Australia and the UN.
We certainly lag behind. Every other Western democracy has either a Bill of Rights or Human Rights Act. Certainly we don't compare well to our peers.
Dr. McGoffey says a Human Rights Act could give groups like the Wunnanibali more grounds to have their case heard.
People can try to bring things through the Australian Human Rights Commission or through the courts, but ultimately address a human rights issue, they have to go to the UN. It may give people more realistic pathways within their own country to bring human rights complaints.
She says enacting such a bill could also help legitimise human rights complaints within Australia.
There can be this perception that these people over in Geneva have made these decisions about us. What would they know? So in some ways, we would be taking the control and the responsibility back into our own domestic law.
David Patterson, KC, is a Canada-based lawyer who was previously the chair of the International Bar Association's Indigenous Peoples Committee. He says UN recommendations, especially those focusing on Indigenous policy, need to be seriously considered, even when they're not considered legally binding.
There are lots of circumstances in which people don't have moral or don't have legal obligations to do things, but it's ethically the right thing to do. It's the appropriate thing to do. When somebody tells you, and somebody who has a fair bit of expertise in the area and is responsible for supervising the implementation of a treaty, says to you, look, you guys aren't really living up to your obligations under the treaty. You should take another look at it. Well, you should.
While some call for huge changes to be made, Scott Kalnan says the fight for recognition continues, and he's urging the government to reconsider its stance.
There has to be a change of position. The Wunnanibali can't give up because they don't have any choice in the matter. It's a question of survival for them.
Lawyer Scott Kalnan there, ending that story from Charlie Mills in the Pilbara region of Western Australia. In a statement, a spokesperson for Australian Attorney General Michelle Rowland said it takes its international human rights obligations very seriously, and the federal government is carefully considering an inquiry into the country's human rights frameworks. You're listening to Australia-wide with me, Sinead Mangan. It's lovely to have your company. 10-year-old Joanna Lamb was taking a break from her schoolwork and headed out to her cubby house, only to be greeted by a brown snake. It struck out from beneath the floorboards and bit her left big toe. Thanks to her family's fast response and a helicopter rescue, Joanna survived and is now planning to say thank you by selling two family cows to raise money. Claudia Sullivan has this story.
Joanna Lamb is an optimistic kid and, like the rest of her family of beef producers, loves being outdoors. But even this tough 10-year-old Queenslander admits she was a bit stressed after being bitten by a brown snake in September. And it wasn't the more common dry bite. She was injected with a snake's deadly venom.
When I got bitten by a snake, I ran up to the school room and Mum wasn't even out the door by the time I got there. And she took me inside and saw the snake bite, so she put a belt just under my knee and then wrapped it with bandages. Dad was down at the yards just about to get him over cattle in, so he come up and drove us to the hospital. And then I got flown out by a helicopter, which was fun.
It was fun, was it?
Sort of.
What was everyone like who was helping you as well?
They were really nice and they were checking my eyes with flashlights just to see if the reaction, and they were checking my heartbeat to check if it was good. And every 5 to 10 minutes in the ICU hospital in Rockhampton, they would take some of my blood. When I was in emergency, I had one nurse and she said, it'll be fine. I've been here for 20 years and I've seen so many snake bites and now only two have been envenomated and they've both been snake catchers. And then the bloods come in and it went from one nurse to five nurses and two doctors very quickly.
Wow. So what was it like then when everyone came into the room?
It was a little bit stressful. My toe was hurting like a lot because of all the blood circulation getting cut off. So they had to put me in happy gas. I got my bed up to the emergency room and I think it was 3 days that I had to be in there. But for the first 36 hours, I couldn't get out of bed because my blood was so thin that if I got up, I could hemorrhage inside and they wouldn't be able to stop it.
Wow, that's very intense. Were you scared?
No, I was like, I looked okay on the outside, but in the inside, I was like, I really want to get out of bed.
Was it hard staying in bed for 3 days?
Yes.
Johanna is now in good spirits, but her father, Daniel Lamb, says the day is etched in his memory.
Just all those things run through your head. You know, you don't want to think about a 10-year-old kid having to plan. But anyway, we just did the best we could and got to Rocky in time to get the anti-venom in time and it all worked out. But those first half an hour really or hour was, a little bit traumatising.
The Lambs have organised the sale of two of their prized stud cows to raise money for Johanna's helicopter rescuers.
I've got a heifer and a steer that I have. My brothers are helping me break in. We're taking them to the Brangus Youth Camp to sell and donate that money to the helicopter people, mainly because they saved my life.
That's amazing. That's 10-year-old Johanna Lamb speaking to our reporter, Claudia Sullivan. Things are changing with the government's social media ban now in effect for under 16s. But there was always a time before we all carried a little portal to the world in our pockets. Susan Graham Ryan went back in time with the people of the Good Shepherd Home in Townsville who had some words of wisdom for young Aussies who may be feeling a bit disconnected.
It was so different in those times. We didn't have all the gizmos that they've got nowadays.
You used to climb trees and make friends and I used to go out with my mum and we used to go walk about.
We used to climb the tree. We had the chooks down the back and they had a tree in there and we used to get up in there. Yeah. It was fun.
They were more interested in fishing or beach combing or...
Oh, we used to play in the street and not worry about cars, catch up with the kids in the street.
Sometimes go for a swim down in the creek.
We used to go to the matinees in Townsville at the Winter Garden Theatre. We'd go to the matinees Saturday afternoon and roll jeffers down the aisle of the theatre. You did too.
It was good fun on the bike. You could ride around the block. Yeah, but if you did the wrong thing, Mum always knew. Always. I don't know how she did, but she did.
For some, it was about earning. For others, it was learning.
I actually had to go and make my own money. I started collecting scrap metal. In those days, there's a lot of army igloos from World War II.
We used to go frogging. Oh, I love frogs. And I told my teacher, Mrs. Pollock, when I was probably about 7 or 8, I said to her, have you seen a double-decker frog? And she said, no. And I said, oh, I'll see if I can catch one for you and bring it in. I caught one, a double-decker, and took it into her. And she said, oh, I think you should let that go, dear. Go and put it in the big drain. You know, she never told me what those frogs were doing. She rang my mum. My mum told me years later... And Mrs. Pollock rang her and said, your daughter brought in this, what she thought was a double decker.
Making fun, also about creating.
But you can think of lots of different things to do when you're a kid.
My brother and I, who were fairly close together, and my dad used to go to the races. So him and I do a running commentary on a race. Like, you know, we used it for horses, and it was called a beetle bomb. Like, beetle bomb's coming down the straight, and Blackbeard's coming up, and our beetle bomb wins. You know? Beetle bomb. You remember beetle bomb? Yeah. Yeah, but we actually used to do that every Sunday. We used to sit around and have a little bit of a concert. Somebody might recite some poetry or sing a little song.
And we made a lot of things too, especially all the trimmings. We made the house trimmings, you know, out of crepe paper. And we thought that was wonderful.
Yeah. Sometimes, just sometimes, you had to play inside.
We used to have to make our own fun with what little we had.
We used to play chess, and that's probably my favourite. And snakes and ladders.
Mahjong, but that was for night, not during the day.
And at other times, to keep you occupied, you had to do something that's kept young people entertained across the generations.
I had three sisters and we used to fight a lot. That was fun. They thought they were better than me, but they weren't.
The residents of the Good Shepherd Home in Townsville, speaking to our reporter, Susan Graham Ryan. If you have a long and tiresome commute, spare a thought for Kevin Guinness. The Injibandy elder spent years hitchhiking through WA's north to get his job as a diesel mechanic. Now his story of quiet determination is being honoured with an industry award. Alistair Bates has the story from the Pilbara.
Got up 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning and then just wait out in the road. Still pitch dark, dark there in the road waiting for hours, Sometimes then I'd start walking.
In Western Australia's Pilbara, rolling plains of Spinifex unwind as far as the eye can see, and distances from one town to the next are often measured in multiple hours. So when Kevin Guinness landed in apprenticeship as a diesel mechanic 60 kilometres away, he didn't blink. The only problem, the then 17-year-old did not own a car.
I end up hitchhiking from Roebourne to Dampier Salt. Yeah, it was still pitch dark. I was just quite happy there waiting for a lift,
For more than 25 years, the Injibandy elder has travelled the dusty highways between some of Australia's largest and most lucrative industrial ports. But his journey, much like the iron ore discovery that has come to define the region, began on a sweeping cattle station by the name of Mulga Downs.
I was 7 years old and mucking around with them, with my dad and uncle. We'd muck around with the old Land Rovers. My dad would maintain them, fix it up, and I would be there. Probably like an assistant, I suppose.
Kevin Guinness was born on Mulga Down Station, where Crimson Desert Scrub meets the Hammersley Ranges. By age 12, he could take apart a car engine and put it back together again.
Like, if it's like a dead car, and then when you get it up and running and alive, you make it feel good,
To this day, the Mulga Downs pastoral lease is held by the descendants of the Hancock family.
The story of Lang Hancock's iron ore discovery is almost legend.
Lang Hancock is often credited as the father of the Pilbara's mining industry.
Well, in November of 1952...
His daughter Gina Reinhart remains the richest person in Australia.
Being out on the road, early hours of the morning, I think what kept me going was my mum and dad, because they, in the station, they work for nothing, basically tobacco and tea leaf. Flowers, clothing.
Many Aboriginal people worked on Pilbara pastoral stations for little or no pay. Equal wages were only enforced by Commonwealth law in 1968, and wages continued to be stolen in WA for years after.
That's the thing kept me motivated, kept me going. Well, if my old people can do it for nothing, well, then I can do it for them, I suppose.
Kevin's childhood eventually took him to Wittenoom and then Roebourne, where he first stuck out a thumb.
6 o'clock we'd knock off, then back on the road, highway, By the time I get to back home at Roebourne, probably about 10 o'clock.
And old habits, he says, die hard.
Even now I still wake up early, on my days off. Up and about early, 3 or 4 o'clock, Part of the body clock now, finished. Stuck with it, I think.
Now a national award will carry the industry legend's name, with construction company Tutt Bryant set to hand out the Kevin Guinness Apprentice of the Year Award to one of its academy graduates later this month. Kevin hopes it will inspire the next generation, like his parents once did for him.
So hopefully the young people coming up, hopefully they look at it that way and say, well, if Kevin can stay out on the road, hitchhiking, well then... Surely I can do it, you know, to finish the apprenticeship.
Kevin Guinness still works at an iron ore port, but these days the long-time hitchhiker catches the bus.
Yeah, I'm sort of rich in my own way of, you know, helping my family and friends and people, you know. I think no more walking, I think. Yeah.
Kevin Guinness speaking to our reporter, Alistair Bates. And that is Australia-wide for this Wednesday. I'm Sinead Mangan. Lovely to have your company today. Cheerio.
ABC Listen.